sponsors. Welcome to Backbone Radio. I'm your host, Ross Kaminsky. What a beautiful day here in the Rocky Mountains, not least because of the miraculous finish by Tim Tebow and the Broncos down in Florida. Boy, 3.5 quarters of the worst football ever and then 6 minutes of the best football ever. Pretty remarkable. Congratulations to the Broncos and Tim Tebow. There's something about that guy that just exudes winner. Anyway, there is a lot going on in the world, and we're going to talk about as much of it as we can in the next few hours here on Backbone Radio. Would love to have you join the conversation if you are so inclined. 303-696-1971 is my number here in the studio. I also have Instant Messenger working. My screen name is Ross Putin, R-O-S-S-P-U-T-I-N, on the AOL Instant Message System, or if you go to my website, at rossputin.com. There's a little box over on the right side. You can type in a message. It'll show up on my screen, and I will respond to you over the air if you're send me a message that's related to what we're talking about. Now, we have a couple of great guests coming up. At 5:30, we're going to talk with Penn Fiffner, who many of you know. He's been involved in anti-tax kind of stuff around Colorado for many years, Colorado Union of Taxpayers, and he wrote an analysis of Colorado's Proposition 103 for the Independence Institute that was just published a few days ago, and I understand that most Backbone Radio listeners already know that Proposition 103 is a bad idea, but this is not, I'm not going to explain this to you again just for the purpose of trying to get you to vote no on this thing, because I think most Backbone Radio listeners are already smart enough to vote no on 103. But I want to give you some more intellectual ammunition so that when you're around the water cooler or at the gym or wherever, if you're talking politics with somebody who's on the fence about this thing, that you will be able to convince them why they should vote no on Proposition 103. I had a moment of great pride. About a week ago, I got a phone call from a teacher who was calling around encouraging people to support Prop 103, and after she got done talking to me, and we're keeping on, she called me, after she got done talking to me, she decided she wasn't sure she wanted to support it anymore and stopped calling people to try to get them to support 103. So that was a great moment of pride for me. Coming up at 6:05, we're going to be joined by Christian Adams, who's been a guest on this show before. He's got a tremendous new book called Injustice, exposing the racial agenda of the Obama Justice Department. Again, you can go to Amazon.com and look up Christian Adams Injustice. You should buy this book and read it. If you don't already dislike Eric Holder, you will when you read this. I mean, the stuff that Eric Holder and his underlings at the Justice Department are doing to justice in America is nothing short of reprehensible. They don't believe in anything other than the usual far left view that whites are always the bad guys, blacks and other minorities are always the victims. And when you hear what Christian Adams has to say, and keep in mind he was an attorney in the voting section of the Justice Department, and he was a guy who brought a lot of cases to help black voters. But as soon as anything came along where, under this Justice Department with Eric Holder, where a black committed a voting rights violation against someone who wasn't black, this Department of Justice will not support it. And it's not just about black and white. There's all kinds of other stuff where this Justice Department will support a minority just because they're a minority at the expense of the rule of law in America. It's really terrible. Now, we have a lot of other stuff to talk about. There's a lot going on in foreign policy. We're going to talk about Libya, Tunisia, Iraq, and we'll get to all of that in a second. Coming up in the 7 o'clock hour, I want to talk some more about domestic politics, though. What do you make of Herman Cain's back and forth on the issue of abortion over the past several days, other statements he's kind of had to take back? Is it just a sign of that he's not an experienced politician and that he can and should be playing that stuff as a positive, or is it, does it get to a point where someone can only claim ignorance to a certain degree, and after that just starts seeming like he's really not ready to be president? I want to know what you think. Again, we'll talk about that in the 7 o'clock hour. And I want to spend a couple minutes here talking about some things going on in the rest of the world. Clearly, the big news of the week is Libya. Muammar Gaddafi is dead. A lot of people are, for some reason, trying to figure out whether he was killed in an initial attack or whether someone later shot him in the head. I don't really care which it is. I'm glad he was shot in the head, however it happened. Had I had the chance to shoot him in the head, I certainly would have done it. And whoever did do it, I'm sure he's extremely proud of himself. I'm sure his family and friends are very proud of him as well. For some reason, Libyan forces and the people who are guarding Gaddafi's body for right now seem to be covering up the body except for the head. And apparently they've turned his head a little bit so that it's harder to see the bullet wound in his, the left side of his head that apparently killed him. There's also, apparently, Gaddafi's will has been found online. I guess he made a few copies of it, but one was put online. And in it, he asked to be buried in his hometown of Sirte. I'll read this. "Should I be killed, I would like to be buried, according to Muslim rituals, in the clothes I was wearing at the time of my death, and my body unwashed in the cemetery of Sirte next to my family and relatives. I would like that my family, especially women and children, be treated well after my death. The Libyan people should protect its identity, achievements, history, and the honorable image of its ancestors and heroes." And, well, you know, I agree with that last paragraph. You know, I don't think that Gaddafi's wife or kids, especially the girls, I mean, I think his sons were pretty badly behaved guys, and I think at least one of them was killed in the same action that killed Gaddafi himself. But I hope that the rebels, who are no longer the rebels, they run the country now, I hope that they don't go out and try to take revenge against either Gaddafi's family members, you know, the ones who weren't active in politics, or just other people who were, you know, of Gaddafi's tribe or whatever. That would be very bad for Libya. At the same time that this stuff is going on in Libya, with the leaders today declaring liberation, that happened today. They officially declared the country's liberation. They are waving the new flag, and it's a remarkable day. At the same time, over in Tunisia, which many of you will remember is the country where this whole wave started across northern Africa and the Arab world. For those of you who don't remember the story, I want to say it was maybe December or January. There was a guy who I actually think he had a college degree, but he couldn't get a job, and he was trying to sell fruit in the street, something like that, and he was accosted by police officers who basically told him, "You can't do that," and this was his only way to make any money to be able to feed his family. And in response to what he considered to be totally unfair actions by the police, as well as a certain remarkable level of disrespect for individuals and rights, he lit himself on fire, and he died. And that set off the entire Arab Spring. It first resulted in the former dictator of Tunisia, Ben Ali, fleeing. And now, today, Tunisia is having their election, their first election for I don't know how long, their first real election anyway. There are a bunch of different parties out there in Tunisia, and it's, you know, probably a little too nuts and bolts to get into all of it. There's a moderate Islamist party that's likely to get a plurality, if not a majority, and there will be a lot of other discussions once that happens as to how Islamic they're going to make the country. You know, will they require women to wear veils? Will they allow the sale of alcohol? Stuff like that. And we'll have to see how it goes. You know, I heard Bob Kagan from the Brookings Institution speaking on one of the Sunday shows this morning, and he said that he's optimistic that there can be some kind of peaceful coexistence between Islam and democracy. And it occurred to me when he said that I'm not at all sure there can be a peaceful coexistence between Islam and democracy. But on the other hand, we don't have very little choice right now but to hope that it's possible. I mean, if you look at Tunisia, if you look at Libya, Egypt I'm less hopeful about, but maybe the people in Egypt will watch what's going on, you know, to their east and to their west, and perhaps do something that will surprise us by giving the Muslim Brotherhood less power than it seems like they might get at this point. But, you know, we don't have too much choice as far as democracy and Islam, because we're certainly not going to eliminate Islam in these Muslim countries. So we have to try to hope that this thing that can work out for these countries that want to go down the democratic road, even if it's not quite the way we would want it. It's certainly better than letting them turn into Iran. When we come back, we'll talk a little more foreign policy and much more right here on Backbone Radio. Stay with us. Backbone Radio. Now, of course, Libya and Tunisia are not the only places that have a lot of stuff going on. The other big news of the week was President Barack Obama announcing that he's going to have all U.S. troops home from Iraq by the end of the year. That goes against the recommendations of his top military leaders, who wanted to have something on the order of 18,000 troops remaining, and then they agreed, the military leaders said, well, we could probably live with 3,000 to 5,000. But in the end, Barack Obama was unwilling or unable or uninterested in reaching a negotiated settlement with the leaders of Iraq that would allow those troops to be there. And in particular, what happened, apparently, is that the U.S. demanded that American military troops who would remain in Iraq would receive immunity from prosecution under Iraqi law for, you know, anything that happened over there, and the Iraqis refused. Now, so that means that that we're not going to have any troops there, plain and simple. Now, there will be still about 16,000 Americans in Iraq between embassy employees and many thousands of contractors who would be anything from, you know, cooks to truck drivers to security personnel like Blackwater, which is no longer called Blackwater, but, you know, who are basically private military. So there will still be many Americans there. Now, the decision to remove the troops from Iraq, you know, by the end of the year. So we're talking about, you know, 2 months. Theoretically, Obama says every American soldier is going to be home within 2 months. I have to say, I am of a really mixed mind on this. Part of me, of course, is extremely happy to think that American soldiers will no longer have their lives at risk in that sandy country where we've done more than enough already. The other side, though, is that by allowing something less than an orderly transition to the Iraqis, and, you know, it's possible that the Iraqis will be able to take care of themselves, but I doubt it. I think Iran is going to work very hard to gain influence there. By moving so quickly with no kind of orderly transition, it really does seem to leave a gaping hole for Iran to try to gain more influence. Now, the president of Iraq right now, a guy named al-Maliki, is a Shiite, and he's fairly close to the Iranians. The largest opposition bloc in the Iraqi parliament is headed up by Muqtada al-Sadr. Many of you will remember this guy, a little cleric who ran away to Iran when things got hot. He's very close to Iran, and he has been threatening the U.S., basically, that if we don't get all our people out, that he and his people will attack Americans. And he has implied that he will also attack American contractors who remain there. Now, when a guy like that, who is now dressing in fatigues and having pictures taken with an assault rifle, you know, trying to look probably like Osama bin Laden in some of bin Laden's most famous photos, when a guy like that gets what he wants, with America running away in a way that can and will be portrayed in the Middle East as America running away with its tail between its legs, that is going to embolden Iran. Not least because Barack Obama made this announcement that he's going to pull all the soldiers out of Iraq just days after we learned that Iran was trying to kill the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. and blow up the Saudi and Israeli embassies here, you know, in America. So it really will be spun in that part of the world as if we're just chicken. We're just running away. Now, not surprisingly, many of the Republican presidential candidates are not very happy with this. John McCain, and not just candidates, but other Republicans. John McCain, I saw him this morning on, I think it was the ABC Sunday morning show, and he said, "Today marks a harmful and sad setback for the United States in the world. I respectfully disagree with the president. This decision will be viewed as a strategic victory for our enemies in the Middle East, especially the Iranian regime, which has worked relentlessly to ensure a full withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq." Mitt Romney said, "President Obama's astonishing failure to secure an orderly transition in Iraq has unnecessarily put at risk the victories that were won through the blood and sacrifice of thousands of American men and women. The unavoidable question is whether this decision is the result of a naked political calculation or simply sheer ineptitude in negotiations with the Iraqi government." So my guess is that it's both of those things. And to me, Obama's decision, and I repeat, part of me is not unhappy with the decision and the fact that we will have fewer Americans at risk there. And I'm... You know, these soldiers, I spent some years of my childhood on a Marine base. You know, these soldiers from the various services, you know, you're talking about kids, you know, mostly, you know, from 19 to 30 years old, mostly. A lot of them have young families, young kids, and I don't want any more of them to die. Now, if Iran gains a foothold there, that could be a huge problem. We have to hope that Iraq really will stand up for being an independent nation and not turn into some kind of puppet like Lebanon or Syria has become, and of Iran. And I think there's a reasonable chance of that. But having spent $800 billion on this war, do you really want to kind of put it all on red at this point, you know? So why did Obama do this? I think there's a few reasons. First, I do think there was ineptitude in negotiations with Iraq. I think they probably could have come to some sort of agreement. Although, to be fair to Obama, I think that the people who are running Iraq right now, al-Maliki in particular, and al-Sadr, who al-Maliki is probably somewhat afraid of, were not interested in actually reaching a negotiated settlement. So, those who say that it was just purely bad negotiating by Obama, that's probably not true. But why does Obama want to do this? I see two reasons. First of all, he made a campaign promise, and he's broken every other campaign promise of import, I guess with the exception of Obamacare, which is a big one, but one that the anti-war left cares about a lot, for example, is closing Guantanamo Bay. And Barack Obama has not closed Guantanamo Bay, and at this point it's extremely unlikely that he will, and the far-left wacko MoveOn.org types are not happy about it. So in order to try to re-galvanize the anti-war base and try to get them to help him in his campaign and donate to his campaign and all that stuff, Barack Obama is pulling all the troops out of Iraq so that he can campaign on having done that. The other thing that I think he's doing, and you really don't hear too much talk about this, but I think you'll hear this soon. I think Obama is going to claim, you know, that some number of billions of dollars, you know, tens of billions of dollars, let's say, maybe even 100, that he'll claim has been saved by his getting out of the war early and that he can therefore spend it on other things rather than just saving it and reducing our debt and deficit as any normal family would do, right? You cut your expenses when times are tough. You don't say, "Oh, I cut my expenses, you know, by $1,000 a month on, I don't know what, refinancing my mortgage or cutting out my country club membership or whatever." You don't say, "Oh, I can go spend that on something else." No, the whole point is that you're saving the money. I think Barack Obama is going to claim savings from ending the Iraq war earlier than many had thought, a little bit earlier, and he's going to try to then go spend that money, mostly giving it to unions. Penn Fifner right after these words on Backbone Radio.